Welcome to Sermons from First Presbyterian Church of Palo Alto. Each week we share a recording of the Sunday sermon, offering theologically progressive, social justice-oriented reflections grounded in scripture and in what's happening in our lives and around the world. Most weeks the sermon is preached by our pastor, the Reverend Tom Harris, and from time to time we're joined by guest preachers. The following sermon is from the 10 a.m. service on Sunday, February 8th, 2026. Pastor Tom reflects on the story of the Samaritan woman.
So the story of the Samaritan woman, or the woman at the well, is a great example of Jesus breaking down barriers between people. In this story, he crosses the gender barrier of his time that said men and women should not speak with one another. And he crosses the ethnic religious barrier that said Jews and Samaritans should hate each other. He crosses both very intentionally when he crosses the border between Judea and Samaria. We're told in verse 4 that he had to go through Samaria. He had to go through Samaria, but he didn't have to go through Samaria. In fact, most Jews traveling north from Jerusalem to Galilee would go around Samaria because there was so much animosity between Jews and Samaritans. Samaria was on the west side of the Jordan River. It's what's known today as the West Bank. And the more common route from Jerusalem to Galilee for Jews would be to cross the Jordan River to the East Bank, travel north along that bank of the river, and then cross back over once you'd cleared Samaria. Now, the animosity between these peoples was very unfortunate, considering how closely related they actually were. Historically, they were the same people. Samaritans had been part of the United Jewish monarchy under King David and King Solomon. And then after just about 100 years of that monarchy, the kingdom split into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. Then the southern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrian Empire in 722 BCE. The elite of the northern kingdom were taken into captivity and never heard from again. These are also known as the lost tribes of Israel. The Assyrians then forcibly resettled people from five different nations into that region, and those people mixed with the poorer Jewish people that stayed. Remember when the northern kingdom was taken captive and into exile, it was just the elites that were taken captive. They didn't take the entire population. So the people of the land were left. And when these other people were forcibly resettled, they began to mix the poor Jews of Samaria with these five other nations. Keep that number five in your mind. But the poor Jews of Samaria retained their Judaism in terms of their devotion to the first five books of the Bible, or the Pentateuch, or the Torah. Those were their only holy text, where the Jews of the South added to the holy text. They added the historical writings, they added the prophets, while the Samaritans only held the Torah as holy. Now that's important, this conversation, because the Samaritan woman and Jesus were talking about where worship was supposed to be. And the Torah never mentions Jerusalem. The establishment of Jerusalem as the capital didn't come until the writings, where King David conquered Jerusalem and made it the holy city. So that's where their disagreement comes in. For the Jews of the South, Jerusalem was the capital, and you worshiped on Jerusalem. For the Jews of the North, they didn't recognize that. They believed in Mount Gerizim was the place where they were to worship. And that's what Jesus and the woman are talking about. And that's the root of the animosity between these two people. It started 300 years before Jesus, and it continued right up to the time of Jesus when he is talking to this woman, and when we are told that he, quote, had to go through Samaria. So what does it mean that he had to go to Samaria when in fact he didn't really have to go? It seems like John is saying that going through Samaria was necessary, not for practical reasons, but it was necessary for the mission of Jesus. That he was a Jewish man whose mission was to offer the world a more universal access to God. And to accomplish that mission, he had to go through Samaria. And so on this journey, he is tired and thirsty, and he stops at a well. He sends his disciples into the city to buy food, and a woman approaches the well. Following the protocols of the time, he should not talk to her because she is a Samaritan and because she is a woman. But he blows past those barriers and says, "Give me some water to drink." Now, let's pause and talk about this woman. We learn some things about her in the course of the story. For one thing, we learn that she is a competent theologian and historian who goes toe-to-toe with Jesus in a religious conversation. We learn that she is skillful and courageous in navigating the potentially hazardous cultural and gender traps that Jesus is presenting her with. How should she respond to this stranger, this man, this Jew, approaching her while she is alone? This conversation is much riskier for her than it is for Jesus. We also learn that she is extremely persuasive later in the story because she persuades her entire town to come out to the well to see Jesus. And in addition to those things, we learn that she had five husbands. And the man, look, listen to you all. And the man she is with now is not her husband. And of course, that's the detail that male biblical scholars throughout history have gotten all excited about. Forget all the other stuff, all the qualities, all the merits of this woman. Let's talk about those five husbands. Okay, so let's talk about those five husbands. One interpretation is a symbolic one. You remember a minute ago I said that Samaria had been forcibly settled with people from five nations. Well, given John's propensity to use characters as symbols, this seems like a pretty good explanation for the meaning of the five husbands. The woman represents Samaria, or the Samaritan people, and her five husbands represent these five nations that were historically settled in Samaria. The one she is with now, who isn't her husband's, could be the Roman Empire that is occupying the land. And to me, that seems like the most likely explanation, but it also feels like a lost opportunity. It's a lost opportunity because here we have a woman in the Bible who speaks more words than any other woman in the Bible, except for Mary. And in this is a conversation where Mary's words are, you know, the Magnificat, which is a wonderful, revolutionary poem. But here we have a woman really engaging in a theological historical debate, which is unheard of anywhere else in the Bible. So if we have this woman who has all these wonderful qualities, who has all of these speaking parts, I don't want to reduce her to just a symbol. So let's consider another possibility. Another possibility is that she is a woman who is caught in the levirate marriage system. That was a law that required a man to marry his brother's widow and try to have children with her in order to carry on his brother's name. It was all about the male name. And that was a real thing, and it comes up multiple times in the Bible. So this could have happened to this woman five times. And the man who is not her husband would be the last brother in the line who perhaps refused to marry her and do his duty according to levirate marriage. Maybe he offered her protection, but refused to marry her, which also is referenced multiple times in the Bible as something that happened. If we read her character this way, she is someone who has lived a very hard life. She's lived with a lot of grief and a lot of loss and very little agency over her situation or her body. She is someone who has been forced into multiple sexual relationships without her consent. Does that remind us of anything in the news today? If we consider the social status of women at the time, and that women were little more than property of their fathers or their husbands, and given that this woman has been married or owned by five men, passed around from one to another, and was owned by one now that she was not married to, and that this probably started when she was a teenager, I can't help but wonder whether this woman is that different from the girls who have been sexually trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein. If she is she so different than these girls who have been kidnapped and abused and passed around and raped by Jeffrey Epstein and the powerful men in his circle? Each girl who was abused by these powerful people like the Samaritan woman, had merits and qualities and gifts that were completely disregarded by these powerful men, so that the men could use the girls and abuse them physically and sexually and emotionally. Every one of those girls had agency that was denied to her for the sake of these powerful men and their desire to dominate. With that connection in mind, I want to hear the voice of the Samaritan woman as the voice of these girls. These girls who must have hungered for liberation and thirsted for safety and still today dream of justice, who yearned for a water that would mean that she could never be thirsty again, that she could come to this well, she would never have to come to this well where she is vulnerable and approached by strange men again. She wants that kind of water. And I want the voice of Jesus in this text to be offered to all of these girls, where he basically says, and I'll paraphrase, right now you are bound by the corruption and rot of the powerful people and institutions all around you. Right now, powerful people use you to their own ends. But a day will come filled with spirit and truth. A day when those who harmed you will be held accountable and you'll be free to begin your healing. A day when you will know real safety and love and justice. After this conversation, the disciples come back on the scene and they can't believe Jesus is talking to a woman. It's a jarring transition. Jesus and the Samaritan woman have just had a life-changing conversation about religious, cultural, ethnic, and gender divides, as this woman yearns for something that she's never known, and Jesus yearns for her to find it. And all the disciples can see is a woman who shouldn't be talking. I think the disciples are all those in our world who hear the evidence of the Epstein files and just refuse to believe it. They are the people who don't believe women. Those who see testimony after testimony from these girls who are now women and disregard their voices and silence them and only seek to protect the corrupt and powerful men. Then in our story, we are told that the woman leaves the scene and she goes to spread her story. She goes to tell her truth to anyone who will listen. And she's still out there today telling her truth. So are we like the disciples who only see a woman or a girl who shouldn't be talking, or will we listen to the voices of girls and women? Do you see that all the abuses of power in our world are connected? The abuse of girls and boys and women and mothers is the same as the abuse of migrants and indigenous people and brown and black people. It's the same as the abuse of the land and the oceans and the air. It's all connected by greed and a desire to dominate everyone and everything. All the oppression and all the injustice in the world are the same. Injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. Our story ends with a Samaritan woman brilliantly persuading the townspeople, come and see. And so they do. They come and see. Their eyes are opened. But notice what they say. We no longer believe because of what you said, but we see for ourselves. So that means they did start by believing her. They started by believing her words. They believed her enough to look for and see the evidence. May we all be like the townspeople and start believing women first. Now, I may sound like a broken record here, but Jesus in this gospel represents something. He represents not just a historical person, he represents the early church's practice of radical inclusive love. And that's the salvation that's talked about in this passage. We are not being saved by an idea, we're not saved by a doctrine, we're not saved by some God in the sky, we're not saved by anything that happens in our heads. We are saved by the practice of radical inclusive love in diverse communities. I'm sure you've heard the phrase, we are the ones we have been waiting for. Some attribute that to Obama, but it is actually uttered first by a South African woman named June Jordan. And she wrote it in a poem that she recited to the UN. It was a poem written to commemorate a protest in apartheid South Africa, where 40,000 women and children came together to protest apartheid. And Jude and Jordan wrote this poem and recited it at the UN on the 40th anniversary of that protest. And I'm going to read it to you. Our own shadows disappear as the feet of thousands by the tens of thousands pound the fallow land into new dust that, rising like a marvelous pollen, will be fertile. Even as the first woman whispering imagination to the trees around her made for righteous fruit from such deliberate defense of life as no other still will claim inferior to any other safety in the world. The whispers, too, they intimate to the inmost ear of every spirit now aroused. They, carousing in ferocious affirmation of all peaceable and loving amplitude, sound a certainly unbounded heat from a baptismal smoke where, yes, there will be fire. And the babies cease alarm as mothers raising arms and heart high as the stars, so far unseen, nevertheless hurl into the universe a moving force irreversible as light years traveling to the open eye. And who will stand? Who will join this standing up? Who will join this standing up? And the ones who stood without sweet company will sing and sing back into the mountains and, if necessary, under the sea. We are the ones we have been waiting for. The most powerful men in this world will not save us. Their rotten souls care for only their own power, and they will abuse any man, woman, or child to increase that power. For our salvation, we have to go through Samaria. We have to intentionally choose to engage and elevate people who have been disregarded and abused. We have to cross the barriers Jesus showed us by his example how to cross. Our salvation will only be found when we hear and when we listen to and when we believe the most abused in this world. Our salvation will only be found in the spirit and truth of radical love practiced in the most diverse communities. Our salvation will only be found in the voices of women and children and Black and Brown and Indigenous people of the world who have never stopped speaking the truth. Our salvation will only be found in the earth itself as she cries out with every drought and flood and record high temperature and every extinction. In these voices alone will be the salvation of the world. Who will join this standing up? These are the ones we have been waiting for. Amen.
Thanks for listening to sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto, located at 1140 Cowper Street in Palo Alto, California. If you'd like to worship with us, we gather Sundays at 10 a.m., both in person and online. And you can find more information about our congregation, worship, and ministries at fpcpaloalto.org. We hope to see you soon.